Welcome to the Aquarium Max audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 123, recorded July 23rd, 2012.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello.
We've got some cool news. If you've been following our Facebook page, then you already know, but our beta have fry.
Yay!
Or our betas have fry. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. We have
can
fry.
You use beta as just a plural, too?
Well, some
or three
do.
Beta?
Some people do, I guess, but I think most hobbyists don't. Anyway, we've got fry, and it's cool. And if you haven't seen them yet, go check out our video. It's on YouTube at the Aquariumax channel. It's also posted on Facebook, the Aquariumax page, and it's somewhere else. Where else is it? Oh, Twitter, if you follow us on Twitter.
Oh, Twitter. So. I forget about Twitter because I don't tweet.
Yeah.
Only Aquariumax tweets.
Yeah, I don't tweet personally either, but Aquariumax does. So anyway, there you go. You can check out the video. You can see the male taking care of some of the fry.
And the babies, or the eggs.
You can see, yeah, you can, well, I don't know if you see actually eggs in the little video, but you do see him catching fry, and you see them whizzing around up near the top of the bubble nest and so on, so it's kind of cool. We're very excited. I'd like to thank all of you who have sent well wishes for the beta breeding project, and especially to Carlos in New York for his beta interview, which I listened to again and again in the weeks leading up to this. And it's fun because, like we said to Andreka last week, you can do something, you can be keeping fish for years. I've been keeping them for about 34 now, and because I got them when I was four. That's when I started, so.
Yeah.
The cool thing is, even then, this is a new experience for me because the last time I spawned betas, I was 13, as I've mentioned before, and
so it's been a while.
It didn't progress to the fry stage because the male ate the eggs. So this is fun. This is cool, and our whole family's having fun with it.
Yes. Okay, so today we are going to hear from Ryan in Arizona, Tony in New York, Mick in Carnforth, Boston. No, not Boston and Robert. Robert in Boston. Sorry, Robert. And Juliet in France.
Okay, well, so first we have Ryan in Mesa, Arizona,
uh-huh.
who has contacted us before.
Yeah, and he has a few tips for culturing and feeding live food that he's come across. So first he has a couple different infusoria recipes.
I love this. I'm actually trying this out right now.
He says, take a turnip and dice it into half-inch cubes. Dry the cubes. He puts them out in the desert sun for an afternoon, or you can use a fruit dryer or your oven on low. Next, add water from an established aquarium to a jar along with one of the dried turnip cubes. The culture will be ready to use in a few days after it clouds up and then partially clears. And then he says, I recently discovered that you can use a canned green bean instead of the dried turnip cube.
And that's what I'm trying right now.
Mm-hmm. So we're making infusoria for our beta fry for
indeed.
When they're ready for that. His next tip is for collecting microworms. He says, I would occasionally get cultures where there just weren't many worms climbing up the sides, even though looking at the culture I could see thousands of shimmering worms on the surface. After some internet research and experimentation, here's what I've come up with. Put a small piece of paper towel on top of the culture to act as a barrier for the culture medium. On top of that, place a piece of cut-to-fit filter padding. The worms will swarm into the padding and can then be removed by swishing the padding in a container of water.
That's a cool idea. I had the paper towel variation, or paper towel on top of the culture, I had used and also suggested to other aquarists when they're having problems, they need them right away and they're not quite climbing yet. But the filter padding on top, that's an added bonus because removing them from the paper towel, I've used like cotton swab or whatever, mm-hmm. but this is, I think, a better idea. So thank you, Ryan.
Okay, now help me visualize this. The paper towel is in between the culture medium and the top of the culture and the padding?
Yes.
Is it taking up the same amount of space as the padding, or is it smaller than the padding? How do they get to the padding if the paper towel's there in the way?
Okay, well, the worms climb on top of the paper towel.
So it's
naturally.
Not as it's not the same size as the culture container, it's smaller?
Yeah, usually, yeah. And then you put a piece of filter padding on top of that.
That is the same size as the culture container?
No, smaller.
So are the paper towel and the padding the same size?
They don't have to be. No, I imagine they could be, but they don't
What's
have to
be. What's the purpose of the paper towel?
Okay, the moisture wicks up into the paper towel, and then the worms crawl onto it. And that's
okay.
the purpose. You want to get pure worms crawling on top of the paper towel, So that you can harvest them without getting a bunch of the oatmeal-y gunk.
Okay.
So that's the purpose of the paper towel. Then the filter padding is a lot easier to remove them from the filter padding because you just take the piece of filter padding up and swish it in the tank. Trying to peel the paper towel off would not work very well. I have used just a cotton swab to just lightly brush across the top of the paper towel, but I like Ryan's idea better. It works better.
So is the paper towel there just so that you don't get oatmeal goo stuck to your filter padding?
Kind of, yeah, yeah.
Okay. What makes the worms go on top of the paper towel? They say, I get to climb out of the oatmeal?
They're inscrutable exhortations that come from their soul. That's why.
They have paper towel exhortations?
Yes. No, I'm sure it has something to do with looking for oxygen or whatever. I don't know what it is.
Or they're just going, ew, oatmeal, get me out. Yeah.
But they'll climb up onto any, you know, surface that's there because there are so many of them.
They just climb up.
And they just climb up any surface they can, so it's probably that. I don't know why they do it exactly, but good idea.
Okay, so his last tip, he says he stumbled upon it completely by accident. He says, I was removing excess snails from my bed of breeding tank by adding a bowl-shaped seashell with a canned green bean in as a bait. The betas ended up spawning before I removed the shell and bean, so I just left it in there so that I wouldn't disturb the nest. A few days later, the fry were due to become free-swimming, so I added a few droppers full of infusoria to the tank before going to bed. The next morning, I noticed some fry hanging around inside the shell, and upon closer inspection, noticed a cloud of infusoria around the green bean. The sides of the shell were keeping the infusoria concentrated, and the fry quickly learned where the food was. Whenever the infusoria cloud got too small, I would add more to the shell. The shell also works well to concentrate microworms since they sink. This could be really useful in a tank with gravel. Alternately, a small bowl would work just as well as a shell.
I love this. This is really cool. This is one of those observations that advances, you know, the aquarium hobby. So I love that. Using a piece of infusoria food, like the green bean, in the tank and some sort of
container
to hold them in. I love that. That's beautiful. So mm-hmm. I have tried the green bean recipe for infusoria, which I haven't used before. I've used all sorts of stuff. Never used green bean before. So I'm trying it now, and it seems to be working because I started the culture yesterday with some water from one of my Daphnia cultures, some aquarium water, and a few green beans in there, and it has already clouded over. I could already see little tiny little particles zipping around in random directions when I started it. So I knew there were a lot in there, but it's bloomed already. The bacteria part has bloomed. It's clouded over with that. And you can see the clouds of them. So it's not going to be long, I think. In a day or two, which is about when our betas will need it, we're going to have a nice culture. So thank you for that tip. All of those tips. Great tips.
Okay. So now we're going to Tony in New York.
All right. What does Tony have to say?
He's talking about Fishless Cycling Land.
Oh, yes, he's been doing
Fishless Cycling
Land. We're
in Betaville, he says, and he's in Fishless Cycling Land. So he says, in Fishless Cycling Land, things are continuing slowly. The weather has been warm, so no need for a heater, but still waiting for those nitrites to go to zero before trying out Daphnia. Ammonia is consumed nicely, but still too much purple on the nitrite test. Except that second 1 gallon, the one he started last, seems to have zero nitrites. That seems positive, but ammonia isn't dropping as fast as I'd like. Time will tell if that will be my first cycled aquarium.
I hope it happens soon. The 3-gallon tank that I'd been cycling at work, I noticed cycled in 18 days from beginning, although I did introduce a little media from another tank, but not very much, but I did some. Probably helped to some extent. Anyway, the thing I noticed is that one day I tested it and I had high nitrites, zero ammonia, no nitrates. Next day I tested it, zero ammonia, zero nitrites, and high nitrates. Boom. One day difference. It was crazy. Mm-hmm. So I'm puzzled why this is taking so long. But it's true that this one's 3 gallons and that's one, and it's a little trickier, but I don't know. I wish you the best. I hope that works. And he had a cool suggestion for a beta name. I really like it. I think I'm going to name a beta this soon. Bonaparte. I love it. Because, you know, it's got the distinguished air, but it's also kind of warlike because of Napoleon, you know?
And, you know, they're small.
Plus, Napoleon was Corsican.
And betas aren't, but
and
that's okay.
And I don't know if that's anything. But anyway, it's a cool idea.
Corsican, Thai.
Yeah.
They're almost the same thing, right?
Anyway, I did like it, and so I'm going to use it. But Kelly had actually already dubbed our newest beta Cumulus.
Because he looks like a cloud.
He does, because he's mostly white, and it kind of floats there. So
we almost changed his name the other day, though.
To what?
We used to have that one beta who was really aggressive, and we named him Beat Up the Whole World, because that's what he wanted to do. And Cumulus has been so gentle this whole time. He hasn't hurt the female at all. He didn't even chase her out of the nest after they
That's why she was eating some of the eggs, not eating.
And so we almost changed his name to Hug the Whole World.
Because he's such a gentle beta.
Okay, he says he's got some other news too.
Cool.
He set up a 6.6 gallon in his office just for fun, and he's cycling that. He says, I found I could get the temperature up to 80 by leaving the light on all the time and have encouraged some hair algae as a result, but will probably keep going anyway. That aquarium consumes ammonia nicely too, but still nitrites are registering. And he was able to place some of his recently acquired Java moss into that aquarium as well, and it's doing great. If a little mossy, he says.
A little moss
you
between friends.
That
you know.
From, you know, moss.
Yeah. It sounds like it's a cool setup. This is the one he's going to put the killies in?
Yeah, he says he's going to put killifish in it. He found somebody he can get some, it says, gold form Fundolo Panchax Garnieri Lafia.
Yeah, which...
Something like that.
Yeah, and most people use, they say Gardnerai, I think, but that's okay because you did it in the Italian style, which works well. I never complain about that. That sounds cool, because he mentions that those will spawn in the Java moss. They're plant spawners rather than peat spawners or substrate spawners. So
yeah, he says they really like the Java moss, so that should be fun.
And that they can do well in a very small tank, which, you know, 6.6 gallons. That's a cool way to do a showcase those killies. That'll be really new.
Okay, we're going to go to Mick in Carnforth now. Hi, cool. Mick! Okay. He says, just thought I would send you some pictures of my new mini marine setup. With displacement, there are 25 liters of water from 30 total. And I bought 3.5 kilos of live rock and a carib sea bag of live sand. I'm now at the end of my first week of cycling, and the nitrites are down to less than 0.1 milligrams per liter, which is as low as the test kit goes. So I will now start testing the nitrates and see what happens. I'm quite surprised at the speed the levels fell. They were 0.25 at the highest point, but I have been doing 10-liter water changes every other day.
And the live sand probably helps, too, because and the live rock, which ideally, at least, contain all sorts of bacteria that are doing the job that you want them to do. So, in effect, that really speeds up the cycling. And often those are billed as, the live sands are often billed as being instant cyclers. But if you use them, you don't need to cycle the tank. But it's good that Mick is measuring it and keeping tabs on that before he takes their word for it.
Okay, he says, the nearest marine shop to us is about 45 miles away, but well worth a 90-mile round trip to get some really good pieces of rock. I've only used 3 in all. That's a long way. How long of a drive is that?
90 miles.
I guess it depends on how fast you're driving.
Yeah, it does depend on how fast you're driving.
They suggested that when my water levels are good and stable, I should add a few hermit crabs to keep the rock clean. I also found my first hitchhiker yesterday, what looks like a Nassarius. It's a snail. I'm sure it is just the first of many. That's the fun thing about marine tanks.
It is. It's one of the perks.
You know what Forrest Gump says.
You never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
Live rock is like a box of chocolates.
Except much crunchier.
Yeah.
He says he also included a picture of his Benjo cat, which lives with my back Aeneos cories. He loves it in the sand waiting to pop out when I feed white worms.
Yeah, they're cryptic. Those banjo catfish. Yeah, they look sort of like a piece of wood or something.
Oh, weird.
Kind of cool.
So did we put the pictures up on the show page?
We will.
Mm-hmm. Did we put them up on the Facebook page, too?
Maybe. I'll have to think about whether I can do that. I think I can.
Okie dokie. Well, let's take our break.
Okay.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629. or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Now.
Okay, we're back. I bet you couldn't tell, huh? We always say we're back, but probably you guys already know that.
Oh, that's okay. We like to say badly obvious things.
It's just because it's fun to say, we're back. Because really, we didn't go anywhere. We just skipped ahead in the format, but you don't know that, so. Okay, we're back. Robert in Boston sent us an email. He says, this is fun. I like this paragraph. I think we're going to steal part of it for our bio, maybe. He says, once again, I'm stuck on a Wi-Fi train between Boston and D.C. with no internet service. How does that work? Because isn't Wi-Fi internet service? I don't know much about that.
That's what he's saying. He's saying that the train is supposed to have Wi-Fi, but it doesn't right now.
Ah, it's being naughty and it's broken.
Right.
Naughty. Okay. So once again, I've decided to break out the word processor and write a letter to those connoisseurs of fine language, aquariums, and bad jingles about surface area.
Which
I love it.
Written yet.
I was reading this before the show, and I laughed, and I said, we need to, like, put that on our show description.
I do like
it's
that.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It says, over the last month, fish observations have accumulated like the pile of papers on my desk. So here's my pile of mental junk mail, and who knows what this could mean to the field of science. It could mean a lot. It could mean actual advances in the field of science.
I love that.
I think that's the coolest single paragraph that we've gotten ever.
So he listened carefully to last week's show. So.
were we quoting that?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it was last week's
Everybody
show.
Needs to see that movie. I'll say it again. It's just the funniest thing ever. Okay. So he says, pond sense. Now, is this going to be nonsense, or is it going to be common pond sense, or some of both?
Well, let's wait and see.
Okay. He says, I tested the water in my 20,000-gallon filterless pond last month, afraid of what I would find. Despite the bottom being caked with leaves and no water changes, the results showed zero for both ammonia and nitrates. Nitrates. The pond also has less surface area per gallon than my indoor tanks, but it's cleaner. What gives? So, what are your thoughts?
Well, there's a couple things, and this is a cool observation. I think there are a couple of things going on, possibly. One is the bottom being caked with leaves. That is a lot of surface area. So it's possible you have a lot of beneficial bacteria doing their job there on those leaves. I mean, depending on how they're arranged, too, if they're very flat, you're going to have a lot less than if you have them sort of in fluffy piles down at the bottom.
Fluffy piles.
But, you know, you see where I'm going with that, maybe. Possibility that's contributing. The pH at a 6.2 means that most of the ammonia is not going to be ammonia, it's going to be ammonium. And depending on the test kit, some test kits register ammonium and some of them register ammonia. What I mean is some of them will give you the same result whether it's ammonia or ammonium and others will not. They'll
only
pick
if
up
it's
one
ammonia.
But not the other. So depending on the test kit he's using, the pH at 6.2, there's going to be a very small proportion of ammonia and a very high proportion of ammonium if they're there.
Okay.
So that's another thing.
So maybe
to think about.
A different test kit would be in order to find that out.
So you could look into that, yeah, about find out what type the test kit measures.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that I would say is this pond is got a lot of plants in it, he mentions. Heavily planted.
That
and
makes a big
an
difference.
Extremely low fish load. And that's a telling factor right there. You just may be producing, all of this ammonium, in whatever form it ends up being at, you know, mm-hmm. probably mostly ammonia, with an M at the end because of the pH. The plants could be sucking it all up, and you may not even need bacteria doing anything just because the plants may be sucking it all up. They like ammonium. They like it a lot. Plants do. A lot of plants will use that preferentially to other forms of nitrogenous nutrient. They like it. So could be with such a low fish load, you're just getting it sucked up.
It's just keeping itself clean.
Whatever is in there, yeah.
Okay.
So.
That's interesting. Okay, he says, more pond sense. Years ago, I threw 3 small, sickly comets into our unused swimming pool. It had become filled in the deep end with rainwater that turned thick green. I expected 3 dead goldfish the next day, but spotted nothing dead or alive for a while. Years later, I had to empty the contents of my beloved pit of pea soup, and what I found were the most beautiful fish I'd ever seen in my life. Ever wonder why goldfish are called goldfish and not orange fish? I don't. Not anymore.
Well, this is cool.
That is cool.
I've got to say that I've read about this phenomenon on various occasions. A lot of Asian goldfish keepers, those who are into producing really high-quality fish, keep their fish outside in large tubs, like concrete raised tubs, things like that. Keep them outside in these big tubs where they don't have any aeration or filtration or anything. They just let algae grow like crazy.
And they just eat it?
Mostly it's the single-celled suspended algae.
Okay. Which just turns the water green?
They probably end up ingesting a quantity of that, I imagine, too. But, yeah, it turns the water green like pea soup. Mm-hmm. But the fish come out, their colors pop. They're really healthy. The water quality, I mean, all that algae sits there in the water, eats nitrates and all this gunk. And so the fish are, you know, happy as clams in there. And that's one of the methods that a lot of the Asian goldfish producers swear by for producing really high quality fish.
What makes them look so nice? What makes their colors pop sitting out there?
I think one of the factors is probably just the fact that they're in the sun. And so basically they're getting a fishy tan.
Oh,
that's part of it. Because fish coloration does usually intensify in response to ultraviolet light. So they are getting a fishy tan. So their colors get richer. They get the live food, so they probably are ingesting some algae, as I said, whether it's filamentous algae that grows on the sides, or whether they, you know, some fish kind of filter some of that out of the water and ingest it. Like kissing gouramis, for example, do that. I don't know how much, to what extent goldfish do that, but I can't say, really. But I'm sure they're getting some algae one way or another that they're ingesting, which is also healthy. It's full of carotenes, you know, which have good things for their colors in them. And then they're getting live bugs that drop on the water, mosquito larvae, you know, that kind of thing. So, and then the water quality is good because there's all this, you know, this algae that's, like I was saying, taking nitrates out of the water and stuff, or ammonium or whatever it's taking out. It's taking things out of the water that fish don't want there and turning it into biomass. So it's cool. And I wish we had pictures of those fish. If you happen to have pictures of them, Barbara, why don't you send those on? That'd be cool.
That is cool. He may not have pictures because he says it was years ago. But
oh, well, that's true.
If you did, that would be neat. Okay, his next little anecdote. He says, girls' night out. In my pond, female guppies occasionally segregate themselves from the 50 or so males to form their own groupings.
How do they get away from the males? That's my question.
I don't know. Maybe they throw around words like scrapbooking and, you know, Jane Austen, and the boys just kind of say, oh, let's go bowling.
Maybe. I don't know. It's kind of fun, though. I don't even know how, you know, what would possibly work, but I think your theory is a pretty good one. That's interesting.
Okay, the next one, he says, I can't think of a tasteful phrase for this one. Yesterday, I witnessed 5 or 6 male mollies gang up on a single female. Other females in the school were patently ignored. I guess they weren't single. Ha ha. The chased, or chased, that's a visual joke, I guess. Okay, the first one he spells with an E-D, and the second one he spells C-H-A-S-T-E. The chased female tried to bury herself in the muck at the bottom of the pond, but still couldn't repel the intense attack. She finally swam to an area where I couldn't follow the activity. I think she needs some pepper spray.
Well, she might. But I'll tell you what. I know that guppies, I've observed a similar phenomenon in guppies, and from what I can determine, and I believe I read something on this, but I'm not sure exactly, but I think I have, is that the female live bearers, right after they release their young, they are more receptive to mating, or they're more attractive to the males, right after they release a batch of young. And so I have
noticed...
Is that
just hormone smells or something?
I'm imagining it has to do with pheromones or something. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that I've read about that specifically, but that would be my
your guess?
Summation. Yeah, a guess in the situation. But it would be interesting to find out more about that. But I have seen females just having given birth being pursued by a group of guppy males, and there's usually a successful mating involved, which is interesting because
it would just kind of wear them out.
You'd think, but then each baby to the female guppy's mass is such a small thing. It's not like with humans where they have to carry around this huge, you know, proportion of their body weight.
I guess so.
For as long, and also they're weightless all the time, so
it's
quite a bit different. They feel weightless anyway, so it's quite a bit different for them, but I have noticed the males pursue them and often successfully mate with them at that point, and indicating that there's some sort of receptiveness about as close as you get with guppies, because with guppies it's not like a come hither thing, it's more like a I'm not completely ignoring you sort of thing, because most of the time that's what they do.
Yeah.
They ignore the males, but during these times I often notice successful mating. So the female may actually be more receptive to mating right after giving birth.
Although the Molly didn't particularly sound she was all right into it.
That's true.
Excuse me.
The guppy often chases. She'll swim away, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it often results in a successful mating. So
interesting.
Maybe not as... she's not as indifferent to it as she usually is, but she's just playing hard to get. I don't know.
I wonder if do you know if the Molly had recently produced young?
Yeah, that would be interesting to find out.
I don't know if you know that since it's in a pond, but...
Right. But it's certainly something that I've noticed with guppies, a very similar phenomenon. That's it's likely, at least I think, that the Molly is...
Are Molly's like bears?
Yes, they
okay,
are. Yes, they are. In a very similar situation.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess you probably don't remember, but when was that? About 10 years ago, maybe more, we had some black mollies and they
gave birth.
Yeah, they had live babies.
Oh, I totally don't remember that.
we haven't had mollies for a long time.
We've had a lot of fish.
We have.
Okay, his next one is called Sun Worshippers. In my aquarium, mollies are mid to lower level swimmers, but outside under full sun, you'll always find them basking at the surface in the warmest and sunniest part of the pond.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing. Sort of relates back to what he was talking about before. And
with the chewing on the heater?
Yeah, we talked about how they were rubbing on the heaters and how he noticed that they were basking in his pond, and maybe it does have some it's thermophilic behavior, as he mentioned.
Yeah.
So it seems like it would be.
Cat. Curl up in the sun and take a nap. Okay, next one. School isn't for everyone. I have 11 angelfish in the pond, 6 adults and 5 juveniles. They divide themselves as follows. 4 silver juveniles at school, 1 calico juvenile, orange, black, and white, that goes solo and is the only one fearless enough to approach me for food. Among the adults, 3 school, 2 are paired off, and 1 goes solo. Like its juvenile counterpart, the solo adult is not shy, but unlike the other angels, I know his or her history. It's a refugee from my brother's tank and has always lived alone. The other angels were picked up at a Boston Aquarium Society meeting in June, so I don't know their history.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, cichlids are pretty smart for fish, but that's some pretty highly individualized behavior, and you might say that having lived alone most of its life, this other fish is just kind of going along with that.
Yeah.
And there's some sort of socialization process going on. But then they're among those fry, which we don't know what's going on with their history, but they seem to be doing the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, some of them on their own, some not. Very interesting, though. That's a cool observation. I don't know what I can say about that, except that it would be interesting to set up a study and seeing how socialization at particular ages of angelfish might correlate with their behavior, their social behavior later on in life.
Yeah. That'd be interesting. Okay, Siamese fighting fish or Siamese scaredy cats? I introduced about 10 bettas into the pond in April, but have spotted only 2 in the last 3 months. They find a hiding place and stay there. One was under a fold in a liner near the end of the pond, edge of the pond, and the other, a male, was recently spotted flashing before he disappeared under a maze of water lettuce.
Hmm. I'd like to see this pond. Gotta take some pictures, some video of this pond.
Yeah.
Love to see it. But, it sounds like you have a more naturalistic setup for bettas than most people dream of being able to have. So that's really cool to be able to observe that. And
are there other... Is this all the same pond?
I believe it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe they're hiding from the goldfish.
I don't know if the goldfish are still in there, though, because they were in
the swimming pool. Sorry.
Yeah, but it makes sense that they would stake out a territory and stick with it,
mm-hmm.
based on what we know about them. But it's interesting that they would just stay in such a small area when they're only a few bettas in this 20,000-gallon pond.
So. Yeah, and if it is 20,000 gallons, that's a lot more space than they would have in the wild. So maybe they just have a smaller territory and stay there?
They do live in really large bodies of water many times, but based on territory, is that what you mean? Like, they wouldn't have as much space based on territory, probably, because the males will stake out territories even in these large bodies of water. And
but it's not a huge territory, right?
No, the territory itself is not large, even though the body of water they're in is often fairly large, like a rice paddy, pretty big.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but since it's cordoned off into little areas for each male. Right.
Okay, and his last one, he says, greatest interview ever. An interview with Diana Wallstead would be a real coup. Not sure about her English, though.
Well, actually, I think...
Okay, you got to tell me who Diana Wallstead is.
Oh, yeah, Diana Wallstead is the author of Ecology of the Planted Aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
She's also produced other things. I have a couple of her PDFs that she's produced. She's written articles for aquarium magazines, that kind of thing. So she's an authority on... She could, because she developed the method, basically, of a low-tech... a particular brand of low-tech aquarium where you put... basically potting soil or something similar on a bottom layer, and then a gravel over that, and then plant the aquarium and use limited filtration, mostly for water movement, and you plant the heck out of it, and the plants thrive in that environment. If you have fairly low stocking levels in terms of fish, high stocking levels in terms of fish, or in terms of plants, and then you get fairly low light, but if possible, a period of natural daylight. But in terms of electric lights, fairly low light, and then maybe some, you know, a few minutes of sun or some natural daylight from a nearby window, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she produces some pretty interesting aquariums. And not only that, but in her method, water changes are reduced substantially because of all the activity that's going on, the biological activity and in the substrate and so on. Water changes are not quite as necessary because the nitrates end up staying quite low. You still need to do them, but not as often. And it's a pretty cool setup. I'm experimenting right now with a Wallstead method nano or pico tank, I guess, with Pelia and a shrimp, where I've got the potting soil underneath and then I've got the gravel on top. And the shrimp's happy. The Pelia is really happy. Right now I'm still working a little. There's a minor algae problem in there, but it's not too bad. And it's working out. I mean, it's kind of scary doing it in a pico tank. I don't recommend starting out with that. But yeah, it's a cool method.
And where's she from, you said?
I'm not sure where she's from, per se.
I'm just wondering what he means about her English.
She lives in one of the Carolinas right now.
Oh,
so
well,
I'm not sure where she's
from. Did they speak English in the Carolinas?
No, I'm sure her name looks German or something.
Yeah, it does.
But I don't know where she's from, but she lives in the Carolinas. I can't remember which one, but I've been trying to track her down, actually.
Neat,
so I've tried to track her down before, and upon reading Robert's email, I tried to track her down again, having a hard time contacting
her. Does she have a website?
She does.
Sort of?
Have websites that she's on, at least, and forums. So I'm just trying to find out where I can email her.
So she doesn't have, her own website?
Well, I'm still looking. I'm still looking.
We'll keep looking.
Yeah, but anyway, I'm going to try, because that would be cool.
Okay, we're going to do Juliet really quick. We'll be a little bit over time, but hopefully you guys will be okay with that. She says, I went to the south of France for 2 weeks to get away from the cold and the rain we've been having up here since May, and left the shrimp and bettas in the care of a friend, this time telling him not to overfeed no matter how hungry they seemed. Bettas can really beg for food.
Indeed, they can.
Got back to find the new 20-gallon red cherry shrimp tank swarming with babies. Definitely much better to keep these guys in larger tanks where the water conditions remain much more stable. I haven't lost a shrimp since I moved them. The new grayish ones have turned much redder, and all the females are buried. Gave them all some nori today. The Amanos haven't had any since I left, and they raced towards it and tore it to bits like starving wolves. I think that they're even more attracted to it than the red cherry shrimp because of their part seawater life cycle, and probably the iodine or some other trace element in it is essential to them.
That makes sense. Interesting observation.
I thought I had lost my green shrimp in the nano with the male beta, but then I moved him over to the female beta's tank to try breeding them again, as she is more than rotund, and all the shrimp came out of hiding. They too have turned a darker green with very nice darker markings on them. They also have very pale eyes, a greenish orange. In fact, I have never really seen green shrimp like them in photos. Did she send us a picture?
She hasn't, but hopefully she can.
She says, might be a new color. I have them in a nano with black sand, and we'll try and move some into a tank with a pale substrate because they're almost invisible in this one amongst the plants. Maybe that's why they're that color.
Hmm. Yeah, it would be interesting if she does get a new color variety.
Speaking of new colors, some of the new red cherries I was given, who were mixed in with the greens, if you remember, were juveniles and a funny pale color. Two of them have developed into an opaque pale orange and one into a translucent yellow. Now I know what breeders must feel like when a new color pops up. Incredibly exciting, and I would love to separate them and see what comes out when they are bred together, but I doubt I could do anything very worthwhile with only three shrimp and a couple of nanos. Pity, but I will try something, let you know what happens.
Yeah, that'll be cool. It's fun to see new color varieties of anything show up and just see what you can do.
So I said before, the male betta was put in with the female and broke all records of nest building. I went away about an hour and came back to a huge nest. He needs to come
teach our fish.
Yeah,
they're
give
not
her some
quite
lessons.
That good.
The female swims over to it, but nothing. I'm hoping that tomorrow morning might show some activity, but I'm doubtful. Either she is sterile or just fat. You'd think that if she had been egg-bound, she would have reabsorbed the eggs or died by now. I don't ever feed her, though, and she is just as fat after being hardly fed at all during the 2 weeks I was away. Mystery.
That is bizarre. Well, you know, we were just about to take the male, separate our male and female, because we have two males and one female in this breeding project, and others spread around. But anyway, we were thinking this isn't going to work because they're not doing anything. The male and female hang out all the time. Female comes under the nest. The male flares. Everything's looks good. The female's interested in the male. Nothing's going to happen. And then we look in there and started feeding the fish. And I noticed the female came out to eat and the male didn't. And that was my first clue. And I thought, oh, I better check this out. So I looked closer, watched him for a minute. He was localizing his activity to one little corner of the nest. And I said, ah, he probably has eggs. And then I saw an egg fall from the nest. The female grabbed it. Oh, okay.
Take
it finally
out.
Happened.
She's eating them.
So, you know, you might eventually have some success anyway. We were surprised. But hopefully, we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, and she says, too, your male betta is very like mine. He's not aggressive with the female. He displays and builds his nest, but never attacks her, even though I have seen them in the mating positions. Someone out there breeding pacifist bettas?
Well, I did find that study. I can't remember what it was called or anything, but it was a peer-reviewed journal of some kind that said up to 15% of bettas in the study that were taken from pet stores didn't display any aggression to each other, the males. Which I would not ever bet on that, but that's what the study found. So crazy. There are bettas out there that just aren't very
aggressive.
You're
just breeding the aggression out of them, I guess, when they breed more for color.
The more that they've been breeding for color and form in the last few years, they're probably not, you know, the aggression is not a factor that they want, particularly.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, though, because I know some of the fighting ones they're more aggressive than the wild
yeah,
types,
they are.
And they're psycho.
Yeah, the ones that have been bred for fighting are more aggressive than the wild ones, and some of the fancy varieties are still more aggressive because they're descended from those.
Mm-hmm.
But in some of them, less so, I guess. And I guess it's slowly coming to that point. Well, you can hear our kids yelling upstairs, so it's probably time
probably to... Probably means it's time to be done.
Yep. May the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.